God, I want to say that I would rather be with you than anywhere else. I'd rather be with you than on a motorcycle. I'd rather be with you than at an all-inclusive, all-you-can-eat and drink in Mexico. I'd rather be with you than at a playoff game. I'd rather be with you than anywhere else. And some of us feel that right now. Some of us don't believe it. Some of us have forgotten it. I know that you're here to meet us where we are. And I pray that we would become more in tune to the reality of your presence, the reality of the fact that you're not holding out on us. You're good. That's what I say. I say you're good. Amen. Hey, let's thank these guys for really taking us to, man, my goodness. Wow. Hey, why don't you go ahead and have a seat? Elbow somebody on your way down. Well, we're starting this new series of looking at the character and identity of God and how God just overflows with goodness, how he just gives grace. Grace is this commodity that only God operates in, where he gives without anybody working. He overflows goodness without any of us actually earning it or even deserving it. I've been thinking about this character quality, this attribute, as it relates to my dog. I have a dog, Stanley, who at one point was 168 pounds. He's now down to under 120. He's had kidney failure, and now we realize that we're going to have to be making the unfortunate decision to put him down soon. And now's the time when all the dog lovers are really depressed right now. And you know, they say in Hollywood, actors never want to share the screen with an animal because the animal will always steal the scene. But let's just all, those of us who are dog lovers, just on the count of three, just say aw, okay? One, two, three. Aw. Yes, I do love Stanley. I'm not trying to belittle. I've had my share of tears. We'll have even more tears. But I understand that, you know, dogs can be replaced. People can't. But nonetheless, as I understand this, I'm saying, why am I so, like, bummed out by this? And I think that one of the reasons is Stanley, in some ways, embodies grace. You know, whenever I come into a room, Stanley's laying on our couch. Yes, I do allow him to lay on the couch. He's laying on the couch, and as I walk in the room, his tail's going, pat, pat, pat. His tail's, like, whapping the couch. And I can walk out of the room, and 10 minutes later, come back in the room, and he goes, you again. His tail's going as if I've been gone for 10 days. I've forgotten to feed Stanley. I've forgotten to let him out for long periods of time. And nonetheless, he thinks a million bucks. He thinks of me as like a hero. I've over-disciplined him. And in many ways, he's sort of an embodiment of grace. How many of us have dogs in here? How many of us? Yeah, I read some of the statistics. 70% of Americans have dogs. Amazing, amazing. How many of us have mothers in here? I don't want to ask if how many mothers are like dogs, but you know, I think the number of mothers is right around 100% of us have had a mother or have a mother, or 100% of us rather. And it's interesting that God, in this verse in the Bible, I'm going to look at a number of different verses in the Bible. It's somewhat depth for us to see this through line throughout the scriptures, that the God that's described in the Bible is a God that is not holding out on you, a God that will not abandon you, a God that does not want to reject you, a God that naturally overflows values and character qualities that are amazing, amazing. So in the book of Isaiah, chapter 49, it's the first chunk I want to look at today, and it talks about Zion. Zion is a descriptor for the Old Testament nation of Israel, who are God's people. So whenever you see Zion, you understand these are God's people. And we're going to take a look at some chunks from the Old Testament portion of the Bible. I'm going to do this strategically because there is this myth that exists that there is this quote-unquote God of the Old Testament and a God of the New Testament, as if God has a split personality disorder, as if he's schizophrenic, and as the common thinking goes that the God of the Old Testament is just this angry God, this God that's upset, and it seems like every time one of his people speaks, his prophets speak, it's like somebody peed in their Wheaties that day, and they're just angry, they're just upset. And then there's this God of the New Testament, so the myth goes that this is where the God is nice and loving, flower power God, and everything is good, and that's completely wrong, utterly wrong. We see lavish displays of love, mercy, grace, richness, abundance, generosity from God in the Old Testament. And we also see very harsh statements in the New Testament, actually statements of judgment that He is God, he is high, he is above, and he has standards for us. These themes go throughout both books. But take a look at this in the book of Isaiah chapter 49. But Zion said, this is people of God said, the Lord's forsaken me. The Lord has forgotten me. Can a mother forget, this is God speaking, can a mother forget the baby at her breast and have no compassion on the child she has born? Though she may forget, I will not forget you. So people say, man, you know, the way things are going in my life, I just feel like you're distant, God. You're way out there, or you're holding out on me, or you don't even know who I am any longer. You've forgotten, you've forsaken me. God says, no, I haven't forgotten you. I understand you. Like a mother. Can a mother forget a child she's nursed? Now we know scientifically that there's something that happens when the mammary glands are lactating, some connection with chemicals in the brain. There is some scientific, some mystical, magical bond that takes place between mother and nursing child. And God says, can anybody deny that there is this bond that mothers will not forget? Do not forget. Of course, some of us in here are going, actually, Brian, I think my mom has forgotten. Some of us have very strained relationships with our mom. Our mom is absent. Maybe a mom was a great mom, but she's gotten the place of altruism. Altruism. What's the word? Not altruism. What's the A? Alzheimer's. There it is. Altruism, Alzheimer's, whatever it takes. She's gotten to a place of Alzheimer's where she has literally, physically forgotten. So God says, can a mother forget? There's a special bond. Yet at the same time, though she may forget, though in some situations a mom may not be a great mom, or a mom may forget, or a mom may lose her mind, I will not forget you. God says, I'm a mom who's always on her game. I am a mom that has a special bond, a connection with you. I will not abandon you. It cannot happen. You are of my blood. We are bonded together in a unique way. This is good news. This is gospel. When the Bible talks about the gospel and Jesus proclaims the gospel, gospel means good news. This is good news. God will not forget you. God will not forsake you. And anybody who proclaims good news is called an evangelist. An evangelist is anybody who brings and carries good news. One of the earliest evangelists was a man who was at a battle, the Battle of Marathon, when Greece fought Persia, and when Greece held the battle, held the day, a man ran, so legend and slash history says, 26.2 miles from the Battle of Marathon into the chambers where the Greek authorities were, burst in and said, we've won, we've won. He was an evangelist. He carried the good news of their victory and said, we won in 490 BC. And then he fell over and died. And some of you run marathons. I've never quite understood that. The first guy who did fell over and died. And yet we try to do it every single year. But he was an evangelist. This is not a religious term. This was a secular term of the ancient world. Anytime somebody would bring good news, they were an evangelist. We have evangelists today. I was watching 60 Minutes last week, and there was a chef on there who kept talking about the gospel, and they kept describing him as an evangelist of new culinary techniques where he's melding molecular biology with, you know, fruits and all this. So it was pretty amazing. His passion, he was bringing good news of new days in culinary arts, and he was like an evangelist. Steve Jobs is an evangelist. He is constantly proclaiming good news that there's a brand new technological device that you must have to change your life, even though it will actually do nothing for you, and it's called the iPad. He constantly comes in. I like technology. I'm sorry, I just don't get the iPad. I tend to agree it's an iPad at this point. But nonetheless, Steve Jobs is passionate. He's bringing it. He's doing that. And what is it that, in religious circles, in church circles, whenever somebody tends to talk about the gospel, it's the gospel, they're loud and they're angry and they're anal and the gospel, or anybody who's evangelist is somebody who is on a street corner with a cardboard box telling you you're going to hell and God hates you, or anytime somebody's, how is it that people who understand the God of the Bible, say they understand the God of the Bible, there's just not that much good news about them? No one's told their face that it's good news. They bring always bad news. They bring anality. That just doesn't make sense. All of us know evangelists of good news, right? You know people who bring some gospel. There's some people that are just positive evangelists. They bring joy and good news wherever they go. And then there's some people that it is joy and good news whenever they leave. You know, just, okay, you're gone. You've left me. Is it just me, or do I have to urinate in here? I mean, this sound of this, the sound of this constant trickling. I feel like I've got my hand in a warm bag of water or something like that. You know, we were trying to create this natural, lavish display of God's dwelling place, this utter abundance. That's what's happening. If you're on the balconies, this is one of the times the balconies had the primo seats. You folks have no idea what's up here. You can just hear and all that kind of stuff. But this is the imagery of God just abundantly overflowing with good news, wine, and carry it to us. Now, let's look at another story. We'll come back to this one, Isaiah. Here's another one in the book of 2 Kings, and it's one of the prophets. We tend to think of prophets, again, as these people who are always giving bad news. And sometimes prophets do give bad news. The bad news that when there is rebellion, when there is the ignoring of God, there is a justice system that God must uphold. Just as in our country, in our society, we realize that if there's not a justice system that operates properly, that deals with embezzlement, that deals with fraud, then something is wrong and society breaks down. So also, the cosmos breaks down if there's not an ultimate standard, an ultimate being who is totally pure and somehow brings justice in the final analysis and in the grand scheme of things. And so prophets oftentimes are speaking this message to people. And we'll talk a little bit about that next week. But here's a prophet who, again, prophets are normally only seen as bad news givers, as guys who are angry. And we see numerous times this is not the case at all. In fact, we already saw the prophet Isaiah talking about the good news that God is a mother who will not forget you. Here's another one, an Old Testament prophet, Elisha. And what happens here is he's got a circle of followers, a circle of people he's building into, other, you know, people he's trying to help understand God and maybe have the ability to do prophecy, all that stuff. And one of these guys is married and he dies. And here's an interaction that Elisha has with the wife of one of his dead friends. The wife of a man from the company of the prophets cried out to Elisha, "Your servant, my husband, is dead. And you know that he revered the Lord, but now his creditor is coming to take my two boys as his slaves." Elisha replied to her, "How can I help you? Tell me, what do you have in your house?" She says, "Your servant has nothing there at all," she said, "except a little olive oil." Very interesting thing happening here in our society. We are an individualistic society, and if something goes wrong with you, it's never going to trickle down. I mean, you could lose your savings, and then your kids or somebody might not have an inheritance, or might have to take out more college debt. But basically, you make a mistake, it's on you, and that's basically where it stops. In this society, in all ancient cultures, it's much more of a communal society. The family lived and died together. It was their successes or their failures. And so here we have a guy that's in debt. I'm not sure if he's run up his credit cards or he has a chariot payment or what he has, but he's run up his debt. And now that he's dead, the system says there's no governmental bailout. There's somebody else going to just say, go into bankruptcy court and just we'll make it all good. No, your heirs have to work off the debt. And so this lady's sons are now going to be sold into slavery to work off this debt. In our country, our form of slavery was going to another continent, kidnapping people, bringing them back over the water, and forcing them to make us rich. That was our form of slavery. This form of slavery is entirely different. I've gotten myself into a pickle. I've overstretched myself. I haven't planned properly. Somebody's going to make this whole, so I am going to put myself in indebted servitude to you until I work off my debt. And so this woman is just noticing, This is the way it is. This is the way it is going to happen. What's powerful about this woman here, and this is very important, for us to understand the good news of God's lavish nature, we first have to understand the bad news. It's just like the market conditions, financial conditions. We don't really know how good things are financially unless we've been in a bad place. We just don't know. And this woman is grappling with the bad news. The bad news is I'm going to lose my sons. And she humbly accepts it. If we're to experience the lavish love of God, encounter it, the starting point is humbly accepting the bad news. She humbly accepts it. She's not bitter about it. She's not going, oh, this is ridiculous. I can't believe this is happening to me. She's not denying reality and saying, I'm just going to think my way to prosperity. It's all going to be good. She's humbly accepting that her boys are going to be in slavery. She's not going to see them for a long, long time, if ever again. And she humbly asks. In fact, she says to Elisha, who in many ways represents God here, she says, your servant is asking you. She's not angry, she's not bitter, she's accepting reality. Every time we fully encounter and understand the lavish grace of God, it always comes after we've humbly accepted the bad news. The bad news that I am spiritually bankrupt. The bad news that I have offended a God that has righteous standards. The bad news that I've broken the Ten Commandments. The bad news that I've lied, I've cheated, I've stolen, I've hogged attention, I've taken credit that belonged to the team, I've thought lustfully of other people God's created that I'm not married to. And I could go on and on and on and on and on and recognize there must be some payment for this. There must be some justice system. Just like I cry out for justice in my country, I know that there must be some sense of justice for this. And there's good news here, but oftentimes people give the wrong application. Former Lutheran pastor and then Catholic priest, Richard John Newhouse said this, moralizing and legalizing of the gospel of God's grace is a dull heresy peddled to disappointed people who are angry because they have not received what they had no good reason to expect. So sometimes we say, I'm keeping the rules, I'm baby stepping, how come I'm not getting more stuff, how come I don't feel closer? And so what happens oftentimes is people in religious positions will say, here's the problem. If you want to get more, you got to obey the Ten Commandments. You got to tithe. You got to serve in kids club. You got to disconnect your porn. You've got to go over to South Africa. You've got to do that. You got to, you know, all these stuff. You got to unmix your recyclables. You've got to moralize yourself. And so when people say, here's what it is, here's what you got to do. And then when we still don't feel God's grace, God's presence, we're left with only bitterness. Because the beginning point was a heresy, meaning it was theologically wrong. It was not going to get you there. It felt good in the moment. It feels good in the moment for us to think that I can pull myself up by the bootstraps, so I can do it on my own. But in the end, it doesn't work. That's on the conservative Bible side. Then on the more enlightened spiritual side, it's the same thing. You're not thinking enough good thoughts. You're not attracting things to you. You're not operating within your karma. You're not. So nonetheless, even then when stuff doesn't go wrong, it's a dull heresy. It's a system that's devoid of a personal God that naturally overflows with goodness. And we're left to feel like, God, you've forgotten me. You've abandoned me. And then we get bitter. Then we get angry. And all maybe started because we never grappled with the bad news. When I really grappled with the bad news, I was in high school and somebody asked me if I wanted to go on a weekend to play some football away at a little camp. And I went and found out it was the old bait and switch. It was actually a Bible camp and they were going to teach me the Bible. We played a little football, but most of the time I learned this theme of the gospel throughout the Bible. And it actually was a great thing. It was a cool thing. But there was one very uncomfortable moment. On the morning session on a Saturday morning, the speaker is to really drill home the bad news. Drills it home. So it goes into what happens, that there's a holy, pure, pristine God, and he doesn't want to be tainted, similar to, you know, it's gut-wrenching what's happening in our oceans with oil that's coming up, you know. And oil is tainting the environment, tainting the stuff, and now these gobs of oil is washing up the white beaches on the Gulf, and whether or not you put yourself left, right, tree-hugger, anti-environment, whatever you are, it breaks the heart of anybody that there's oil washing up on beaches, and we just go, oh, something isn't right about this. And this guy basically is drilling us in, saying, this is what it's like for us to be in the presence of God. Because of our problems, because of our rebelliousness, because of our sins, we taint the character of God, and he removes himself from us. This is the bad news. Basically, you're on a grease pole to hell. There's nothing you can do about it. Let's close in prayer. We're like, what? What are you talking about? And then all day, really all day, we're going, oh my goodness, I hope I don't break my neck playing football today because I'm going to hell. This is we sat in the bad news, humbly accepting, yes, my goodness, I did cheat in that exam with that cheat sheet. There's got to be recompense for that. Yes, I did. You lie about what I did sexually with this girl at this party. Yes, I did. Yes, I did. All this stuff, we lived within this bad news because Romans 3:23 says, All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. All have sinned and fall short of the glory. Some of us are nicer and better than others, but not all of us fall short of God's standard. It's like if I said the standard was to drive a golf ball into the Ohio River. Some of us would get out in the parking lot and we would do a worm burner or an asphalt burner and just trickle it across the asphalt. Some of us might be able to hit the light at Madison and Ridge. Others of us could hit it 300, 325 yards, but all of us would fall short of the standard of hitting the Ohio River. This is what happens. We fall short, and there's bad news with that. And this woman is in the bad news, and all she has that is of any value is olive oil. Now, today, olive oil is still of value. I still don't understand why it's so stinking expensive. I don't understand if it's because olive trees are hard to grow or hard to get the pit out. I have no idea. But we know today, if you ever bought olive oil, it is expensive. Even much more so in the ancient culture because olive oil was the be-all, end-all liquid. It wasn't just food, which they did use it as food. It was also fuel. You would pour it in a container, put a wick in it, it would light. It was food and it was fuel. It wasn't just that. It was also medicine. If you had a burn or abrasion, you'd kind of put it on yourself externally. If you had some internal indigestion, it was used as a laxative. You would swallow it. And so oil, if you were going to have one thing that was useful and was a sign of wealth, it would be oil. And this is the only thing she has. And so here's where the story continues. Elisha said, "Go around and ask all your neighbors for empty jars. Don't ask for just a few. Then go inside and shut the door behind you and your sons. Pour oil into all the jars, and as each is filled, put it to one side." She left him and shut the door behind her and her sons. They brought the jars to her, and she kept pouring. When all the jars were full, she said to her son, "Bring me another one." But he replied, "There is not a jar left." Then the oil stopped flowing. Now imagine the scene. They go to all their neighbors. They get all the empty vessels they can. They gather them up in their little house, and they shut the door, and they line up. They have them spread all over the place, and she just starts pouring in, and she's thinking, any moment this is going to run out because this is a bigger container than one I have, and boy, how did that container get all the way full? Amazing. Huh. It goes to the next one. Starts pouring. She never has to cock her wrist. She goes from container to container, just keeps going, container, all the way around. And she gets on this one container, and she says, "All right, give me another one. Give me another guy, boys, give me another one." And they say, there's none. That's the last one. And she's watching. She has to cock her, and just then, right at the top, done, filled. She's got this container of oil, and she looks around her, and miraculously, God has multiplied the oil, and it is filling all of these containers. Now, that's an amazing, amazing story, but it even gets better for me. Look what happens here. She went and told the man of God, told Elisha, and he said, "Go, sell the oil and pay your debts. You and your sons can live on what's left." He says, "Go. You don't have to work on a debt snowball plan. You don't have to go get a third job. This is God's lavish provision for you. Sell it, pay off your debts." Now, I used to think that God would never pay off my debts. Just like spiritually, God wouldn't pay off my debts. I've got to work it out. I've got to even the scales. I've got to do some good things to even it out. And then when I saw that, no, God actually does provide, and I thought, okay, well, God will provide just enough. So just enough so that you're not taken into slavery, or just enough so that your debts get paid off. He not only lavishly provides enough to pay off all the debts, but I love that. Take the rest so you and your sons can live. An overflowing abundance, more than what is it? And somewhere along the line, you know, I fall prey to the belief that God is scarce on resources, and he barely doles out pennies like an old miserly woman that doesn't use heat and eats cold oatmeal. It's like, oh, I can only give my people this much. I cannot. No, it's in his lavish nature to just overflow and give grace. And we see this here. God can give grace when you are just worn out and you are suffering and you need to endure, and he overflows and gives grace to allow you to endure another day, to allow you to see something of value. He gives grace and overflows, and we have opportunities to learn that we wouldn't have had otherwise. I mean, there are hundreds, thousands of different ways that God's grace pours over in our lives. And sometimes God's grace pours over to actually make a bona fide miracle, as what happens here. At the last Wednesday service, which happens on the last Wednesday of every month, that's why we call it a last Wednesday service on Wednesday night. This last one, we spend time people giving stories of how God has really miraculously shown up in their life. Some bona fide miracles have been happening around here. And we gave stage time to that. And one of them, a guy was talking, and I know this guy personally, his name is Bob, and you'll see him volunteering and working around here from time to time as well. He told the story about during the free journey when we wrote on the bottom of our shoes lies, things that we believed about ourselves or about God that were not true, that were from the enemy. We had an exercise. We took off our shoe and wrote on the... Why are you looking at my foot? What is your... You got problems. You got one... Oh, goodness, man. Weird person. So anyway, we write on the bottom of our shoe things that were lies that were from an enemy, and then we would put it back on, and we walked around wearing down the lies, trampling them down, trampling it. And so he did that. And then when he did that, he realized on his other foot he had a problem. Years earlier, he had a staph infection that had started in his foot, and doctors had to go in and cut into it, and they pumped steroids into it, and the staph infection went away. But for a long time, he had a mass on the bottom of his foot of tissue, swollen tissue, just some stuff that was there that the doctor said would eventually go away. But here it was years later, and it wasn't away. I mean, it wasn't decommissioning him, but he could feel it every time he was on concrete or anything like that. It was just a nuisance. So he pulled off his shoe, and he drew a circle around the spot on his foot where that was, and basically wrote a prayer, God, would you heal me? And he put his shoe back on. When he walked out, started walking on concrete, he realized, wait a minute, it feels different. He pulled off his shoe, and instantaneously the mass had been gone. It was gone, eliminated. He could see the scar, but the mass was gone. He talked about this, and listened to his interpretation of why this was a struggle for him.
I never really felt like I was important to God or special to God, and I think I got that from my childhood. My dad, when he was around, was physically abusive. That's just the way it was. And I'm okay with that. I've dealt through that, and I forgave my dad. I tried to honor him as being my father, and it got better at the end, toward the end of his life. But I never really got that. And so when I would get something like, a healing, why me? I'm just a guy. I don't do anything special, like a doctor or I'm just a painter. So it was a very nurturing act, because that's what God does. God just lavishes gifts on us, yeah. And it's like you don't have to do anything for this. This is just I'm giving this to you,
yeah.
And yeah. And I never experienced that really. So
that's great. Man. That's great.
No rhyme or reason why that happens with a foot and it doesn't happen with somebody else who has a cancer issue. This is grace. This is not you live a certain way, you do a certain thing, and all of a sudden it happens. There is this thing that we can't control in God's identity where things lavish out on us. And all of us have different things, but the fact is all of us are experiencing to one degree or another the love of a mother, an eternal mother, who is overflowing and will not forget us. Let's go back to God's mother imagery in the book of Isaiah, when he continues after saying, I will not forget you. I will not. He says, see, I have engraved you on the palms of my hands. Your walls are ever before me. Their walls are down. Their city is in ruin. And this is part of why the nation of Israel, Zion, the people of God, are interpreting that God has forgotten, because their life, their city is in a shambles. And we often get like this. We think, can you not see, God? My life is in a shambles. The walls are down. I've been laid off for too long. I've been underemployed for too long. I've got a bad oncology report. My portfolio crashed. My marriage is on the rocks. I mean, all of us at times have walls in our life that are down, and our oftentimes instinctual reaction will be, see, God, you're not there. See, you're cheap. See, you forgot me. See, you're just not there. And if you've ever felt that way, you're not weird. This is normal. This is normal to the human condition to assume this. And yet God grounds us in reality and says, I've engraved you on the palms of my hands. Even if it was possible for me to get Alzheimer's, it wouldn't matter. I got you written on my hands. It's an old movie called Memento. You ever seen that movie? Kind of a strange movie where a guy has short-term memory loss. And so he writes things on himself. So when he loses memory, he has written on him, oh, that's what that means. Bob, he's a friend of mine. And this is what basically what God's saying. Even if it was possible for me to forget, it wouldn't matter because I got a backup plan. You're written on my hands. I will never forget you. And the deeper imagery to this is in ancient times, somebody who would be engraved on, written on, would be the slave. If these boys had gone and become slave to work off the family debt, they would have had a mark on them. Cattle today has a mark of the master on it. The Jews during the Holocaust had a mark as the Nazis actually owned them. They lost their identity. They had a mark on them. These boys in ancient culture would have had a mark on them showing that they were a slave. But masters were never to get marks. Master. God says, I as master, I actually have the mark and it's of you. But it's even deeper than that. He says engraved. It's very clear here. This is not just a tattoo. This is not just a branding. This is what a sharp instrument would do when struck by a hammer. An engraving, what a sculptor would do. He says, I've engraved you on the palms of my hands. And this is why Jesus is so central to the gospel. The good news is that God doesn't just stand above and judge and moralize. That God actually takes on flesh and comes down here. God actually comes down here and actually lives the perfect life that I never could live and I still can't live. And then actually pays the justice that needs to be paid somehow. And how does he? He stretches out his arms, his hands, and his hands are punctured with the sharp instrument of a nail while a hammer drives it through. His hands are engraved with love. His hands are engraved with a God who will not forget, a God who naturally overflows and naturally intervenes. God says, how much do I love you? I got you written right here. I have the scars, I have the puncturing, I have the engraving. Right here. And every time I look at that, I think of you. I think of Bob. I think of Jill. I think of Javier. I think of Carlos. I think of Amanda. I have you right here. I will not forget. It is impossible. And this is illustrated numerous ways throughout the entire Bible. And every once in a while, they encapsulate it in numerous spots. Here's one of the spaces they encapsulate it in the New Testament portion of the Bible, Ephesians 2. Check this out. All of us also lived among them at one time, gratifying the cravings of our sinful nature and following its desires and thoughts. Like the rest, we were by nature deserving of wrath. This is the bad news. The bad news is we understood the bad news that we had offended a holy, pristine, pure God. And by nature, there needed to be payment. By nature, there was wrath to come our way. And we're not going to deny reality. This is why it's so upsetting to me whenever somebody says, well, I've always known God. I go, no, you actually don't know God at all. Because that means you've never been in the bad news. You might have the good moral principles. You might know the Bible. But if you have never grappled and lived in the bad news, you have no idea of the lavish love of God. You're just getting a paycheck on your own morality and making yourself feel good about it. To experience and encounter the lavish love of God, you have to come to a place of brokenness where you realize, oh my goodness, I do not impress God at all. I am stained. I am by nature object of wrath. That's why this next part's so great. But this is the best little but you will ever see. Humorous innuendo. But, because of his great love for us, God, who is rich in mercy, who is abounding in mercy, who naturally overflows in mercy, who lavishes us with mercy, he made us alive with Christ. He didn't make the rules to cause us to get ourselves out of the bad news. He made us alive with Christ, even when we were dead in transgressions. When we had the bad news of not being able to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. It's by grace you've been saved. And God raised up Christ and seated us with him in the heavenly realms in Christ Jesus, a priest, an interceder for us. God himself acted as the priest by taking the sacrifice on himself and then ascended to the heavens and invites us and gives us the grace to get to that place. in order that in the coming ages he might show the incomparable riches of his grace. It's not just grace to escape hell. It's not just grace to escape the natural recompense for our unjust deeds. There's incomparable riches on top of that. It's not just a fail-safe plan to get out of eternal jail. Incomparable riches overflowing on and on and on. It's like a never-ending fountain of grace that continues to trickle on us. It's expressed in his kindness to us in Christ Jesus, the one who had us engraved on his palms. For it's by grace you've been saved through faith. And this is not from yourselves. It is the gift of God, not by works, not by moralizing, not by altruism, but is by the gift of God that no one can boast. No one. You see, if I judge my spirituality or I judge my purity based on the curve, how well I'm doing, how much I've improved, how much I am better than this person, which I think that's why we love the gossip pages. We love to see people's lives implode so we feel better about ourselves. Because we feel like, okay, on the curve, on the grave, I'm doing okay. But God says, no, I don't work it by works. It's not by, if it was by your works, by your morality, by your spirituality, by your Bible verses, by anything, then you could boast in that. And if you boast in it, it had nothing to do with me. It all has to do with your personal fame. God says, no one will take my fame. No one will take the one being, entity, and all of creation, all of universe, all of history, who is only sacrificial, who is only loving, who is only best, who is only holy, who is only great, who is only overflowing with kindness and goodness and grace. That reputation belongs to me alone. You slot yourself under that reputation, you understand you're underneath an ever-ending fountain that will overflow. Hands are pierced for your transgression. My lavish love has caused me to naturally offer up my life as an offering of grace, as an example of grace. And I cannot forget the punctures in my hands. I cannot forget you. As I went there, I was thinking of you. If God had a wallet, your picture would be in it. But God has hands, and your name is engraved in it. He bears the marks and says, I will not forget you. I have not abandoned you. I have died for you. With this in reality, let's hear and meditate on this.